You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
I don't think anyone should think this is a license to continue to breach copyright. iiNet is not responsible for stopping it.
There's no real demand for censorship of the internet in Australia. There's no other country in the Western world, at least, that's trying anything like this.
Netflix aren't better at anything, but we think we've got something, and we call it the iPad.
And today, we're delighted to be present at the creation of digital radio in Australia.
Senator Conroy is completely botching the implementation of this filtering policy of his.
For adults who want to be able to watch the other material, we're not proposing to do that.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hi there, welcome to the Tech Talk Radio Summer Series. I'm Dr. Ron, your host this week. The Tech Talk Radio team is off on holidays, having a well-deserved break. In the meantime, we've prepared this highlights package for your personal edification. A while back now, we heard from Georgia Simmons at the Telstra Foundation. The Telstra Foundation was set up in 2002 and supports community organisations that are dedicated to the lives of Australia's children and young people. From an organisation called Recover My Email, Mr. Graham Henley spoke to us about data backups and data recovery. Graham joined us by telephone and has years of experience in data recovery for mums and dads, as well as small businesses and corporates and government customers. A longtime friend of Andrew's joined us in May 2008. Audio engineer extraordinaire Michael Cremean told us all about home theatres, Dolby Surround Sound, high-definition television, and the annoying volume of television commercials. Also a couple of years back, and got to tell you, it seems like just yesterday, yours truly and Mrs. Dr. On tripped over to England, Scotland, Ireland and Denmark. We managed to resolve our time zone differences, and I called into the panel live from Ireland. Also in this episode, Adam Turner talks to the Sales and Marketing Director of HTC Australia New Zealand at the release of the HTC Magic. The Magic was a follow-on model from the original HTC Dream, or G1, and precursor of the popular HTC Desire, which is now selling like hotcakes. And last but certainly not least, George Pongus spoke to us from popular Australian ISP Domain Central, all about domain name registration. Enough from me. For now, it's on with the show.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
We should introduce Georgia Simmons. She represents the Telstra Foundation. I'm not going to tell you what the Telstra Foundation does. I think Georgia's in much better situation to tell them about that than me. But just in an interesting report on their press release, which is available on the Telstra website, 93% of teenagers use the internet. I'd agree with that. 84% use chat rooms daily. I'd even agree with that. I think there's a huge use. Because remember last year, about November, I think it was, that the social networking sites overtook the mail sites, like the free web accounts, free mail accounts like Hotmail, so that more generated email comes from these sites now than they do off the free Yahoos and Googles and all those put together. So I think, you know, we've got to look at this. Also, 59% of children use a mobile phone. Absolutely. My five-year-old loves it. She knows which numbers to press to call me at work. So
what was that number again, sorry?
Was 59% of the children use a mobile phone. Now, I don't know whether that means possessing one and taking it to school or whether they just use one. And the final statistic, which was also fairly relevant, 33% of children aged 8 or 9 start to use the internet at aged 5 or 6. Let me tell you, my 5-year-old, when she was 4, could find her way to the Wiggles website through the ABC site quite easily. So we're at a stage where parents in particular need to sort of be aware of what the kids are doing and how they're doing it. So I take this opportunity. Georgia, thank you very much for coming in and having a chat to us tonight. Can you start off by telling us a bit about the Telstra Foundation?
Sure can. Telstra set up the Telstra Foundation in 2002 to make a positive and lasting difference to the lives of children and young people. Our focus is very much on connecting children and young people to their communities. And these grants that we're offering are very much about keeping kids safe online. And we're putting $2 million into it.
So these grants are over a period of time, from my understanding, the next few years, is that right?
Next 3 years, we're making a commitment. So we're looking at programs of 1 year or up to 3 years.
And what sort of organisations are you targeting? Who are you expecting a response from?
Yeah, we're limited in a way because of our structure, but we're looking at community organisations that have tax deductibility status. So if schools come to us, we really need schools to come to us with a community organisation, mm-hmm. And to support them that way.
So who would come to you if it's not schools? I'm trying to think of an organisation like a library or something like that.
Probably not a library, but it'd be a community organisation, something like Berry Street, the Education Foundation, okay, the Smith Family, those sorts of things. Also universities. We're particularly interested in research because there seems to be a real a need for research out there, both longitudinal and looking at trends and kids' behaviours, but also looking at, you know, what's actually happening online. Because the research that has been done has been quite small, like quite small cohorts and pretty much piecemeally. So we're looking at some rigorous research out there to actually look at the behaviours, and then that can inform, you know, better programs that really are targeting kids and making an impact and keeping them safe.
What sort of conduit do you have between yourselves and Telstra? Telstra being obviously a fairly sizable player in the internet field these days, they would have a fairly large market share of customers. Is this where you're drawing your research figures from?
No, actually the research comes from a number of sources. It comes from NetAlert, which you'd be familiar with.
Oh, this is the government's initiative, yeah?
Yeah, the government's initiative. That figure of 59% that you referred to in regards to the mobile phone, the usage of mobile phone, the 59% there, actually came from a report, Media and Communications in Australia Families, that was released last year. There's also ChatAlert study, where we get other figures from. So it's really, those figures are sort of coming through through, you know, the research that's being undertaken. But just taking that point, the Telstra Foundation's actually independent, which we're chaired by Herb Elliott, who many of you'd know.
He's the Olympic chap. I know that name quite well.
Never was beaten in a race. And then we also have another four community members who sit on our board. Geraldine Duke, who may be familiar to people.
Journalist, ABC.
Jackie Huggins, who people would recognise from last week, a lot of the commentary about Sorry Day on the 13th. Mm-hmm. And Jackie Huggins is, you know, an Indigenous activist and academic. And Matt Farlett, who established Typo Station for at-risk boys. So they're our community members. And then we have Telstra executives who are on it as well. But the decisions of the foundation and on the board are independent of the commercial interests of Telstra. So we really are focusing on what's best for kids out there and looking at community solutions that, you know, can really make a difference in kids' lives.
So just briefly, what sort of dialogue would you have with Telstra, just because you share their name? Do you do you chat with them regularly and find out
we
trends?
We do. I share an office. we're obviously hosted by Telstra. And we do. I mean, using the fantastic capabilities, expertise and things that we do have on offer, we've actually undergone over the last 2 years a real transformation in regards to what the foundation funds. Mm-hmm. And we're now focusing on funding things in society and really responding to problems and what's called wicked problems out there in some instances, and using the capabilities and the talents of Telstra to respond to those.
Georgia, what sort of things would an organisation get one of these grants for? Is it for education? Is it for application developments, or what sort of things is the Telstra Foundation looking at?
I suppose with what it can be all, and it can be a mixture of everything.
Yeah,
We're not being prescriptive, and I think that's the most important thing. We are really going to the community and saying, give us your ideas. We want to support them. Mm. Obviously, we've got a criteria around that, but the foundation's very much about supporting big ideas. So a lot of our grants, not in necessarily in cyber safety, but in our other areas that we fund in social innovation, are really about seed funding of big ideas to make a social impact.
Tremendous.
You touched briefly on the government's initiative with all the new programs and software that's coming out at the moment. What sort of effect do you think they're having out there in the community? I've heard no reports about whether it's successful or not. I do know that there's been a lot of money spent on it.
Yeah.
From your point of view, have you heard any reports, good, bad or otherwise, about these processes?
I haven't really. There's obviously the filtering, and I think that's with the new government, they've taken the time to really review the filtering. There are some fantastic resources that are online. I think where the opportunity is about the dissemination and putting them into the hands of parents, teachers, health professionals, psychologists, and everybody who comes into contact with children and young people. I think there is, you know, a real plethora of information out there how to keep kids safe online. It's actually getting them into the hands that people can use them and it can be useful.
Georgia, can you tell us a little bit about what sort of grants, how much they are, and how to potentially apply for one?
The grants are starting at $75,000, and as we talked about before, that's available for a three-year period. So it's $75 a year for up to 3 years, or from
$75,000
per year up to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Grants are open at the moment, and it's an online application form. So if you go to telstrafoundation.com,
mm-hmm.
You can find out the assessment criteria, our guidelines, and then complete an online application form.
Have you had any successful takers so far?
Oh, we certainly have.
Do tell.
Earlier this year funded Superclubs Plus, which is a protected social networking site for kids 6 to 12 years of age. And it's a program that has been in the UK for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really fortunate that they want to bring it out to Australia and obviously have all the IP behind it and all the engines behind it. But what it's about is it's a protected social networking site.
Mm-hmm.
It's open from basically when kids wake up to when they go to sleep. And it's got a multi-pronged sort of safety approach to it. Kids have to be verified through their schools that they are children at a school, you know, with the ages and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also then while the site's live, the kids are their behaviour's moderated. And
who moderates?
At the moment, there's a group of moderators going through, and they're trained teachers and trained moderators. So what they're looking for is in those hours, they're actually looking for behaviour. You know, so things like giving out your personal details, your telephone, your surname, potentially, you know, swearing, being nasty to people, the things that we were just talking about before, and really just watching the kids and their behaviours and just reminding them that things are appropriate and not appropriate. Also, potentially, you know, staying online a bit too long and those sorts of issues.
Law enforcement. Do you work with law enforcement much, Georgia?
We don't. We're really fortunate. To support these cyber safety grants, we've looked to expertise within Telstra, and so we've set up an advisory committee. And on that advisory committee is somebody who's in the corporate security investigation unit, and he's also a member on the Virtual Global Task Force that looks at kids safe online across basically the globe. And he's actually in Vancouver as we speak, presenting on the Telstra Foundation and the cyber safety grants, which is fantastic. But he's going to... The Telstra Foundation board is meeting in March, and he'll come back and report to us on new developments, on new connections that are being made, because this is a real global phenomenon.
Yeah, we're not we don't tend to lead the world in this sort of technology. It sort of happens in the US. I think Susan was saying when she was on the show last that what happens 12 months or in the States will happen over here in about 12 months. It seems to flow on a bit. So hopefully, yeah, that's where they get to learn about all those sort of things, really.
Yeah, so hopefully we'll take, you know, some good ideas from that. And that's exactly what's happened with Superclubs Plus is that it's been developed in the UK and we've brought it out here which is being supported. Well, we're funding La Trobe University and Intuitive Media to bring it to Australia and to offer. And what we're hoping to do over the next 2-3 years is bring kids online and educate them and give them those skills, you know, in their younger years of school to be able to make those decisions or assist them to make those decisions.
Georgia, if somebody's not lucky enough to get a grant, they've got a fantastic idea, how closely does the Telstra Foundation work with them to assist in marketing or deployment of the solution that they come up with?
Well, I suppose that's also we're really quite passionate about the projects that we fund. So we see it as a partnership that we want to share the stories.
Yeah.
That it's not, you know, we don't want to just have a report and go, yippee, you know, we've produced a report. It's actually putting it into the hands and making a difference and inform practice and behaviours and make a real, you know, a real impact.
I think from an education point of view and from my kids' point of view, I think it's fantastic what the foundation's doing, and I wholeheartedly support them, and I hope other industry bodies get behind them as well. There's a lot of other ISPs and providers out there which I think would also have a vested interest in supporting online safety for kids and things like that. So I wish you well. Thank you very much, Georgia, for coming in and spending us 40-odd minutes on the show tonight. It's been quite an interesting discussion, and hopefully we'll look forward to seeing some of these grants actually start doing some results in
the
community. All right. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. We'll be back with more after this.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
Tech Talk Radio.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McCollum here. Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, and Jason Dunlop all here. Present and accounted this evening. It's very nice having everybody in the studio. It makes a great change.
Nice and cosy.
It is, isn't it? Mm. Anyway, data backup. Have you had a crisis, Dr. Ron, where you've gone, oh no, and you've gone, oh, this is a problem?
No, data recovery is overrated. We don't really need to. No. I jest. It's very, very important, and we all have. Everyone who's worked in the industry is all, I think we've all experienced that horrible, just about to have a car crash feeling.
Yeah, it's terrible.
You've just discovered that something very, very bad's happened in a data loss sense, and you just suddenly
your hardness makes that clunk sound.
You have a lot of customers, I would have thought, that have been down that.
Yes, I've had customers, but I've been there myself as well, not just customers.
Well, we have Graham Henley on the phone. He's from a company called Get Data. You can visit his website, getdata.com.au. But Graham's had many years' experience in recovering data. In fact, he's done it professionally for organisations like the Australian Federal Police. So if someone knows how to recover stuff off a drive, I would think it'd be this man. Graham, you've had plenty of years' experience in this sort of stuff, I can gather.
Hello, gents. Yes, I've been doing data recovery work in various forms for probably about 15 years now.
And tell me about the, I guess, from a personal point of view, you'd probably be looking at developing software to help the mums and dads, the small businesses, potentially the large businesses, to get their software back when you hear those funny noises, or you accidentally erase it too. I guess that's probably one of the problems too.
Yes, look, that's what my company does now. Get Data was formed as a software development company. So for a living, we go to work each day and we write software. And really, from my background and the background of some of the partners that I work with, it really came from that data recovery field. So when we first started the company, that was the basis.
Is it really that simple? Is it really easy to do it? Because there's a lot of different sort of parameters, I would have thought, to actually pull data back off a drive, especially if you've erased it or the machine's making some strange noises.
Yeah, look, it's it ranges from some very simple things can go wrong with a hard drive to enable you to lose the data, right to some very complex things. And when you talk about data recovery, there's really two types. There's data loss that can be solved with a software solution, and then there's your physical hardware recovery, which is when your hard drive is a mechanical device. It's like a car. It gets old and it wears out. And so when you have physical problems, that's when you actually need to send your hard drive out to a service place that will start replacing those components and getting the data off the drive that way.
Graham, what can we do if we make a really simple, stupid, dumb mistake? If we suddenly delete 500 photographs of our children and our family and realise that we've got that setting turned off that says put things in the recycle bin, and just suddenly we think, oh, no, you get that terrible sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach. I've just deleted everything. What's the very first thing that people should be doing in order to try and recover that data?
Well, essentially, the best thing to do is not to panic, because the data is still out there on the drive.
His famous last words.
Well, the principle of data recovery. Essentially, when Bill Gates sat down, he wrote Microsoft Windows. The way he wrote Windows was so that everything happens really quickly. No one wants to be sitting around waiting for things to happen on your computer. So really, at the start of any sort of storage disk, there's this table. And in the newer operating systems, they call it the master file table. And it's basically like a big spreadsheet that points out to where all the files are on the disk. So when you're in Windows and you actually delete a file, all you're really doing is going to that spreadsheet and saying, let's remove that entry. It's like tearing the index out of a book. But you can actually still go out to the data on the drive and still find it out there on the drive and recover it. So the most important thing is don't panic and don't start writing information to the drive, because as soon as you start changing the contents of the hard drive, then there's a good chance you could write data on top of some of the deleted material, and once it gets overwritten, then it's gone for good.
So what can we do, Graham? Is there software that we need to have pre-installed to in anticipation of this sort of situation, or is this something that we can do straight away?
Our software is called Recover My File. It's really designed so that after a data loss, or you can preempt this thing by having Recover My Files installed in the first instance, but it can be installed after a data loss and used just as effectively. So you download the software, it allows you to run it on your computer, and it goes through its various types of recovery searches that it does, and in the results screen it brings up the results and it shows you in the results screen and enables you to click on the files that are found and preview the content. And once you can preview those pictures and you can preview the documents and read those things that you've lost, then you know your data's out there and you know it can be recovered.
Generation Y, Graham, obviously they're into iPods and the likes. Music would obviously play a fairly large part of their life. And as a result, I guess more and more of us are heading off to iTunes and those sort of environments where they only let you really download the track once when you pay for it. What happens if you've got your life savings worth of kids spend a lot of money on music these days. What happens when the iPod comes to grief or something like that? Can we retrieve information or is there a way of getting that back?
Yeah, look, about 18 months ago, or probably nearly 2 years ago, we started getting inundated with people trying to recover their songs from their iPod. We specifically went out and wrote a program called Recover My iPod. And that program is purely to enable users to get back their music from a failed iPod. But the hard drive inside an iPod is usually quite... they've got a lot of tolerance and they're usually in pretty good condition. So probably at least 95% of the time we're successful in getting all the data off an iPod.
We've been talking on the program a bit about operating systems other than Windows. We've got a Macintosh notebook in the studio now. We've got a notebook in here even running Linux. Operating systems other than Windows, are they just as easy to recover data from when there's a failure?
Our new version of Recover My Files, which is coming out towards the end of this year, will address the Macintosh file system. Now, Macs, while you have Windows computers that are formatted with FAT32 and NTFS operating systems, you get a file system called HPFS on Macintoshes. Yep. So it's just the way that the Mac computer understands the drive. So you need software that knows how to read that file system in order to try and recover the deleted files. But one of the things that Recover My Files does, one of the search capabilities that it has, is that it can ignore all the operating system information, and it can just search across the hard drive. And when you have a file like a Word document, for example, that Word document has a file structure, which essentially means that at the start of the file is specific characters, so they all start a certain way, and basically they all end a certain way. So when you get right down to the lowest level of data recovery, what you can do is scan across a hard drive and then identify some data on a disk and recognize the header, the structure, and the footer, and then chop that piece of data off the drive and say, is this a Word file or a JPEG or a TIFF or whatever file type you're analyzing? And that really means that you can recover a specific file type of any type of file system.
Graham, it's been absolutely fantastic talking. I've learned a lot, and hopefully some of the listeners have also realised, oh, that's not too bad, because we all do, everyone. It's like a car crash, as Dr. Ron said. You do have that sinking feeling when you boot it up and it says net loader can't be found and all those sort of things.
Invalid boot sector. That's as much as you get.
Yeah. So, look, thank you very much for being on the show this evening and just telling us a little bit about the wares and sort of, in a lot of respects, just sort of how easy it is to do. Everything is easy when you know how, isn't it?
That's right. A bit of knowledge is a wonderful thing.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you once again. That's Graham Henley from GetData.com, Get Data Proprietary Limited, an Australian company who are developing software
selling to the world, which is a wonderful thing.
Which
I
is
love
good.
Those stories.
If you've seen some of the stuff on YouTube, it looks a bit strange.
Whilst it is a high-def machine, it's only 720p.
Fraud-def.
Yeah, fraud-def. Yeah, exactly. Take note, Apple, HDMI output cable and carrying case.
Why would I want an Apple TV without a hard drive?
What you're describing is bloatware. The handset formerly known as the iPhone.
Entertaining.
I don't like spam.
Informative.
There are public VPN services.
Independent.
They've run up to, 400, 500?
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And, of course, as you'd expect with an audio engineer in the studio, the show has started already here, and we're going to turn the microphones on now. You can hear what we're talking about. Anyway, welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, and JD here in the studio this evening, and we're being joined right now by Michael Kamian, who runs an audio post-production facility in Melbourne, and no stranger to Tech Talk Radio. He has been in here before, so we can ask him all the questions that we didn't get to ask last time round, and add a few new ones to the mix in relation to digital TV and surround sound and all those sorts of good things that we're no doubt sort of plaguing a lot of home theatre enthusiasts at this point in time. Michael, welcome to Tech Talk Radio again.
Thank you. Once every 2 years is obviously enough for you guys.
Ah, this is good. So what's happened in 2 years? Have we seen any great new innovations come through? Or are we just doing things minorly differently? Or what's happening in the last 2 years?
Well, I suppose we're starting to use some of the newer technologies more fully.
Are we?
That's probably what I would say. It's just that, particularly with television, you know, there's been much carry on about the 5.1 and all that sort of thing. But really, there's very little, you know, let's get real here, outside of the feature film that comes up, which has a massive budget and therefore can afford to do those sort of surround things. When it comes to the stations, it's a massive problem to deal with all that.
It's a very expensive process doing that sort of mix, isn't it?
It is, and it's also a much longer process because you have to think about things. I mean, just think for a moment about a drama where you do a reverse over-the-shoulder shot. And we've got the fridge in the kitchen. You know, we're standing in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. The fridge has gone from the left-hand corner to the right-hand back corner. Now, do we switch that around every time we do a reverse shot? Do you think that's going to be slightly distracting for the audience? Or do we keep it in one spot and work out a sort of a vague centre of where this should be in the signal?
Well, depending on the budget, drop it all together.
Oh, yes, exactly. But all I'm saying is you have to think about things much more deeply when you start going surround in terms of where things are, or you have to take a simple approach, which is to give 10% of the sound to the back channels in terms of your Tweety Birds and things like that, so that two things, it's not distracting, and secondly, with an average production, it comes in at a reasonable budget and you can do it on a weekly basis. And then just spot certain things to other channels.
Michael, is there content at the moment which is being made in surround sound specifically for television, or is it still mainly...
Do you mix for telly, I think?
Yeah, is it still mainly movies that
it's still mainly
airing?
Movies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a massive extension. To be honest, I don't think even a lot of the clients understand that.
Mm.
How much more is involved once you go to 5.1 or 7.1 or whatever you like? It's just a massive, bigger path. I mean, that's why Dolby, quite rightly, came out with Dolby E. When was that? It's a few years ago now. Was designed largely because they realised that stations couldn't afford to put the infrastructure in for all those extra channels. So Dolby E was a clever data compression to fit all that and more information down a standard stereo set of conductors that most stations would have as their normal routing around the place. So even analog, you know, plugging would be able to carry this.
Because when I hear the word Dolby, I automatically think 10, 15, 20 years ago it was
a cassette player.
Yeah, it was a noise reduction technology. It was synonymous with noise reduction, yep. Now, so Dolby E is a way of compressing audio. Yeah,
there will be Dolby A to Z if they have their way
right,
over the years.
Right.
But yes, there has been they've gone through a few letters and a lot of domestic standards and a lot of commercial standards in noise reduction, but they're a smart company and they've looked at all these other things. I mean, Dolby AC3 is a data compression, not a multi-channel situation, which is what most people think.
Now, AC3 is what we have on DVDs, isn't it? That's where we get the surround information.
It is basically just a data compression and it is not lossless. And it was used in studios like this for quite a few years before it was ever conceived of in these terms as a straight stereo format for using on cart machines and things to fire off quickly to air. And a very good system, still used in a lot of stations for the music that turns up in the news, things like that. But then, of course, it's been used more completely now. But this is what Dolby E is. It's a very smart compression. Don't ask me to go too far into this because I don't understand it that much myself, but I can tell you that it will take about 10 generations. That's what they say, and probably a lot more, but you know that's what they're willing to bet on without any real loss.
What do you mean by 10 generations without loss?
In a station, you see, you're copying things, although they're becoming more tapeless all the time. They are going through tape from time to time, or they're assembling reels that will have advertisements and things like that. So they take programs, they want to put them into promotions, they want to do things like that, so they get copied back.
So you mean
and forth.
It decodes it back to its audio format and then re-encodes it again at the other end?
Is that right? Okay.
Well, if you've got enough Dolby units in the place it does, and that's the one issue with it, is that it does actually delay things 2 frames when they do that, so everything's passing around out of sync.
Oh, good.
And you've got to pull things back into sync, you've got to decode.
Digital television's full of sync issues, isn't it?
Well, it is. We all know that. I mean, I don't know how many people have said, why are the stations all out of sync now? And I say, what have you got? And they said, well, I bought a cheap plasma. And you go, all right, I'll walk away from this now, because immediately you know that the lag time on that is adding to the system. And
that's a good question, actually. We were going to talk about some domestic stuff, and let's just conclude with the Dolby E. So Dolby E is a technology which is really used in the broadcast world.
Yes. It's not for you guys out there. You will never touch it. Do not worry about that 2 frames. That is something that is a bit of a headache for the stations, but it's still better than trying to lay miles and miles of discrete cable to deal with all this.
But thinking about television... digital television and the bandwidth that comes down to your TV in your lounge room, Michael, is this going to impact on the bandwidth that's available for the video?
Yes, absolutely.
So my pictures at the moment are going to look even grungier and even more pixelated supposedly high-def channels.
No. It is as is. I mean, it's allocated. They're not going to change that.
But, so there's a fixed bandwidth for the audio as separate from the video. They can't...
Yeah.
Putting a 7.1 sound channel on it isn't.
Well, they would
steal
have to work
bandwidth
from
the video.
Don't say it's beyond the realm of possibility, but I'm just saying yes, they've got their allocated area. They will not muck around with that. So
interesting.
That's good to know.
Mm. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the loudness of TVCs, television commercials. For those not in the game, are they really as loud as you think they are? Well, we'll dispel some of the rumours and fuel others, I think.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Dynamic range. It's a wonderful thing. It's loudness and softness, and there's quite a bit of it in a movie these days. When you put that up against a television commercial, the TV commercials seem louder, according to some people. Is this the case?
I reckon they do. I reckon they're much louder.
Is this the case, Michael?
I'll tell you why I reckon that, because I have to turn the volume down when the commercials come on, because they're louder than the program. But they seem louder.
Uh-huh.
Then I always crank it back up again.
You wouldn't do that, would you, Michael?
Yeah, you have to turn it up to hear the dialogue in the normal program. Yeah,
you do. Yeah. My father complains about that all the time.
I turn the subtitles on.
That'll do it.
The subtitles louder? No, sorry.
No, but the braille's violent. sorry, had to get that one in. Listen.
He's being very non-committal, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. I got to say, I think... the Cowboys were more back in the analog era when it was all analog and there were no agreements or anything. And I used to work in advertising way back then too. And basically a whole pile of people from an agency, when a commercial was being mixed, would file in to the back of a studio and sit down, and the bloke at the front would sweat. And they'd say, louder, 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 and that's what they'd get. They wouldn't understand what they're doing, mind you. I mean, but it was, some studios admit to having a panel of lights they used to turn on to impress people too, that had nothing to do with the gear.
Still do.
But it's, not going there. But there certainly was a push to do that until somebody said, stop, enough, and all of that. But just to look at it from another angle, please, keep in mind that the stations want the money from the advertisers. They want you to keep watching and listening and don't want you to switch off. So it's not actually in their interests to annoy you to death either.
That's never stopped them before, though.
Well, the situation certainly in analog land was quite clear, and that was that stations have station clippers, which stop everything from rising above a certain level, but they have automated systems below that, although way back, of course, you used to have a person riding the controls. But the aim of the game is not to push the transmitter into clipping. And the thing about making a commercial subjectively loud is that you crush the dynamics, which means the lowest low is closer to the highest high. Now, when that passes all the people in the middle and gets to the transmitter, or in the path to the transmitter, the station clipper takes over and everything rises up to whatever that preset level is. So if the peaks, if I'm not getting too far into things here, the peaks in an ordinary drama are well above the average level because they want to be able to reach that note that'll make you jump. So the average dialogue level and everything, and it's more so in films where you're in a quiet cinema than it is when it's mixed for television, but the same still applies. They keep it at a certain level and so that they can ride it high when they want to for effect. But when you get to the commercial break, they just want you to get it. So certainly back in the analog days, they had woken up to the fact that if you crushed everything up, it would all rise up, quite apart from anything the station wanted to do, because the station clipper would hit normal programming, hold the peaks at a certain level, and all the average sound would be well below that. But when you came to the commercial, it would do the same thing. It would try and hold the peaks there, but the average level was closer to that point.
Michael, it's been an enlightening evening, I guess, talking about all these sort of things. We can go on for hours about audio. It's a very interesting topic and very passionate about it for some people too, especially when you do radio and television for a living. You can certainly talk about things like sound effects and how you place them and things like that. Oh, it's fascinating. But thank you for coming in this evening. Thanks, Rob, for letting you come out tonight, because I know you've probably got a few other things you should be doing. But we've learned a lot. It's been great. Again, we'll have you back in another 2 years.
I was going to say, can you hold the doors up that long? Yes.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. You've been listening to Michael Cremeen there from Audacious Productions. He is a proprietor of an audio production facility in Melbourne who does lots of TV shows. You fish a bit, you cook a bit, all those sorts of things, and does the odd radio commercial here, there, and everywhere as well.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Now, let's talk about Freeview.
Hey, someone just joined the wave.
They're the people I want to avoid the calls from.
Comes in very handy, especially when your files get really, really big and corruption takes place.
So you're an AAAAAAA.
Dude, it's not even a beta. It's just for us to play around with.
They also cited taxes and freight costs.
Just mount it on your desktop and run it through.
It's a big risk.
Oh, you watch the webcam.
Yeah.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Oh, it's very regal, isn't it?
What have we got happening here?
I think Dr. Ron's about to enter the room. He's currently in Ireland. We spoke to him earlier this evening. Mm. And he's taken some time out. Very graciously, we are here at the Tech Talk panel to hear that he's having a cup of coffee, sitting up there somewhere. He's not quite in England. He was there yesterday. So
oh,
it's
right.
Wrong national anthem.
It's the wrong music. Yeah.
It was this on the Doctor Who theme, so I just happened to find this. Anyway, this is Australia calling Ireland. Come in, Dr. Ron, are you there?
Coming in base, over.
There he is. He's there. Dr. Ron, welcome to Tech Talk Radio. You remember us?
Thank you very much. Yes, I do remember you. As far as the music goes, well, I'm in the north of Ireland, so I suppose you get away with that a little bit more than you would if I was in the south, but that's okay in here.
So what are you doing? How's the holiday going? Have we caught you at a bad time, or what's the weather like? 20 questions. Your turn now.
Do I ask the questions or do I give the answers? My first question is, what's up with JD and the Dell computer? I'll leave the country for a couple of weeks and the place sends the crap.
Don't worry, by the time you get back, it'll be gone.
Okay. Good to hear, JD. No, I'm actually, at the moment, I'm in Ballycastle, which is a small town up the northeast of Northern Ireland. So it's in County... I'm looking at my map here. Hang on a minute.
This is Google Maps not working.
The joys of being a tourist. Yeah, what's going on with the Google Maps? Hey, we've got Street View here now. Have you seen?
County Antrim. We're in County Antrim. I have. I had a look at Street View the other day. It's incredibly fast, and all the addresses I punched in, they all came up very well with photographs of the addresses. So that's very good.
Did they blur your house for you, as you asked?
Yes, and my number plate's been blurred as well on the Audi and the Volvo at the front too, so that's good.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Now, tell me, how have you found technology in your trip so far? Has it all worked for you? Obviously, you're using your Australian mobile phone provider over there quite well. How's it? How's coverage? Better than expected? What's it like?
No, it's very good. The mobile phone's been working extremely well. I'm talking to you at the moment on my little iMate, and I've been using that for Wi-Fi as well as for mobile phone communications, and I'm roaming at the moment on O2 UK. That's the carrier that I'm roaming on. But in the major cities, like in Belfast last night, and also in the major cities in England, I've had 3 coverage, and they're pretty good. They just charge a 25-cent flag ball for making calls and for receiving calls, but otherwise the rates are the same as they are in Oz. So technology-wise, everything's been going well.
What about public Wi-Fi? Have you been able to get the thing to connect onto any Wi-Fi networks over there?
Yeah, I have, Graham, heaps. And a really good example was in Manchester, where there's just free Wi-Fi everywhere. Australia's really got a lot to learn.
So how has the rest of the technological journey been so far? Obviously, Wi-Fi is working for you. You're roaming really well. It just seems to work, obviously.
It does. TV's really good. Everyone's got dozens and dozens of TV channels here through BBC, and there's also ITV and other channels as well. The radio is terrific. Australia is just a technology backwater when it comes to digital stuff like television and radio. The driving around in the car, you can just hit the button for your traffic information every half hour. Your program is just briefly interrupted by traffic announcements with any congestion information or breakdown information on the whatever motorway you're on. So it works extremely well here, the digital radio. And that's not DAB either. I think that's what they call RDS, which is the traffic information services. But there's also DAB available as well, which is the fully digital high-def audio radio.
What's the price of petrol? I was curious to note in Ireland at the moment how the economic scale of things is going.
Yeah, it's about, at the moment, I'm driving a diesel car, which is it's a little Peugeot diesel, and it's going great guns. And the diesel's about, at the moment where we are here, I think I saw before in Ballycastle, it's about £1.30, which is probably about $2.60, $2.70 a litre in Australian language, but that's about the going price here. And you say to people that it's half that in Australia, and their jaw just hits the ground. They go, "What? How come it's so cheap over there?" But, of course, we're just always moaning and groaning about how expensive it is at home, aren't we?
Have you got any internet access, or are you using it purely on the, have you experienced friends, families, email connections, internet connections over there, or using it purely on your little portable device?
A bit of both. I've been using the portable device when I've been travelling in the motels, but staying with friends and family, they've had internet available in their houses, and it's very, very fast here. I was very impressed with the speed, especially serving sites from Australia. It's been great. So they're all pretty much exclusively using DSL, but it's a very fast DSL. It's not what certainly not what we're accustomed to. It's like really fast, like cable broadband at home. We'll be going back to Bournemouth at the bottom of England towards the end of the trip, and we stayed in Bournemouth for a few nights with my wife's brother, and he's got a computer there, and he's got a little Wi-Fi router, which was great that I hooked into. And he's got very fast internet access there. So I'll have a look at it and give you a proper report in a couple of weeks' time.
What's the cost of internet like over there? Have you had a bit of a look-see, or you've just been touristy and using it?
Apart from it being free, it's really good. But if you have to pay for it, it's the same probably like it is anywhere in internet kiosks and motels, probably a pound or a couple of pounds for half an hour or an hour. Just depends on where you go. And If you buy your lunch and your coffees at the same place at the same time, then it tends to subsidise your internet access, but pretty comparable.
We had a listener email us, I think Brian, you've spoken to him, I think, via the show when you were this side of the planet before, in relation to the BBC and their licensing fees for television and the likes, £139 a year. To subsidise the BBC. Have you spoken to anyone about that? Do they there's any grumbles about that, or do they think it's all money well worth spent?
No grumbles. Most people think it's money well spent, and from what I've seen, it's a very good service that the BBC provides. They've got all the television channels in addition to the radio channels. They've got news, which is just non-stop. It's like on BBC One, and they've got programming on the other channels as well, so... Yeah, they're also another thing that to mention is that they're turning off analog, I think, sometime in the next 6 months or so. So there'll be no more analog. And I was getting questions from some of the family members over here. What do I need to do, Dr. Ron? Do I need to buy a box, or do I need to get a new TV? Because the pressure's on now. They're really starting to turn up the heat when it comes to switching off the analog signal. So that'll be interesting to see how that evolves over the next 6 months or so.
Is there much of a problem with that? Or if everyone just sort of, you know, taking it in their stride?
Everyone's just taking it in their stride. There's not much of a problem because most people have switched over already, like in the last few years. It's just the last of the technophobes, I guess, that are starting to hit the panic button.
Ah, yeah, there's plenty of those. There are people that like to find problems with those with anything, really.
Now, how many digital TV channels are there over there free to air?
I'll find out for you, Graeme. I'll let you know next time we speak.
Cool. And just briefly about the mobile phones, because we'll have to let you go, surely, Dr. Unkers, time is not with us at the moment. You're using third-generation technology. Is it fast with data and that? Have you given it a bit of a run for its money?
I haven't used any data. I am on 3G networks everywhere I go, but I've avoided the data just purely from the cost consideration, and I've just been using Wi-Fi where I've been able to on the PDA. So I haven't given that a go. At the moment, just using the phone for voice.
And that's been working okay. Just obviously, you rang me this evening, your number popped up, so that's really nice to know that it all works across the seas.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's really good. It just comes lights up with your name on the phone when you ring, and SMSs are working a treat. They're going backwards and forwards without any problems at all. So it's all very, very seamless. You just hop off the plane, turn the phone on, and you've got coverage. Off you go.
Fantastic.
Now, your mobile phone provider did a really good service with the international roaming. You've kept your number. It's not costing you a fortune to make calls while you're overseas, if I understand correctly from what you've said. But they didn't provide you with data roaming of any kind?
They probably have data roaming, Graeme. I've got to do some research on the costs. I'm just a bit wary about accidentally, attaching myself to a partner and roaming with a partner on a 2.5G network, in which case the cost is going to go through the roof. So that's what I'm concerned about there. I might hop on the net a bit later and have a look at some of the prices. But if I can safely guarantee that I'm going to be staying on 3 or whatever the 3 equivalent is over here, and I stay on a 3G network, and I'm not going to get hit with exorbitant data rates, and I could probably use it for data okay.
Hey, Dr. Ron, it's been an absolute pleasure, as per normal, having you join us in the... There's a chair here just waiting for you when you come back, so it's been terrific. So thank you, and thank Lainey too for allowing you the time to come and play with us this evening.
All right, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me on, and I'll give you another report next week, and looking forward to coming back and sharing all the stories and having a bit of a slide night at some point in time.
Oh, dear, do we really want a slide note?
Digital slide note.
Yeah, exactly. And you can put those up on Facebook or Twitter or whatever
all
you
that,
do.
All that Grogs he's bringing back will help with the slide note.
That's a point, too, and a few Guinnesses, too. Have a Guinness for us, Dr. Ron. It'll be, several Guinnesses for us.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Okay, we've taken the view from the couch to Sydney again this week, and I'm talking to Anthony Petz, who's the Sales and Marketing Director for HTC in Australia and New Zealand. Anthony, welcome to Tech Talk Radio.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Adam.
Now, we're here today at the launch of the HTC Magic, which is the new HTC Google phone. Anthony, do you want to start off by telling us a bit about the differences between the first generation, the HTC Dream, and the new Magic?
Quite clearly, there's a fundamental difference between the Magic and the Dream. One is very simple. Keyboard, a hardware keyboard on the Dream, and then with the Magic, it's a touch keyboard, mm-hmm. a touchscreen device. That's quite the fundamental differences. So what we've got is the Magic is now an addition to the family.
Yeah, so you'll still be able to buy the Dream.
Yeah, definitely, still be able to buy the Dream.
And the Dream is from Optus.
That's correct.
And the Magic is with...
So the Magic is going to be available with 3 and Vodafone.
And there are slight differences between the 3 and the Vodafone versions.
That's correct. There's actually 2 different variances that we have available in the market. So we have the HTC Magic available with 3 and the HTC Magic with Google available with Vodafone. And the slight differences are quite simple. They only are slight differences. The core functionalities are basically the same. But if we look at the Vodafone one, the Vodafone one has the ability to get all the firmware updates over the air. Whereas with the Magic, the HTC Magic with 3, that'll be, if you want an update, firmware update, you'll need to do it via your PC.
And what's the reasons for the differences between them?
With the Vodafone one, that's actually a three-way partnership between Google and Vodafone and HTC. And basically, the Google can develop the operating system for that one and on all the applications and the features and functionalities. And that was done with Vodafone. Whereas with the 3 version, that is between HTC and also with 3. And basically, the applications and functionality are developed jointly together between those two parties.
Okay. And so it's an 850, it runs at the 850 megahertz frequency, so you could use it with Telstra, but you won't get the next G speeds, is that right?
Yeah, 850 is for the GSM side. Okay, so that is what we call 2G.
Yeah.
Okay. In the 3G operating, the frequencies is actually 900, 2100.
Yeah.
So it'll work with the operators, all the operators on 2100,
yeah.
Which is generally metro area. If you want regional coverage, then that is generally either with the NextG, say 850, or with the Telstra, with Vodafone and Optus, they're 900.
So if you put a NextG SIM card into it, would you get the NextG coverage footprint, but just not the NextG speeds?
You wouldn't get the NextG footprint, okay? Mm-hmm. You would get it in 2G, okay?
So would it be Edge or just GSM?
Yeah, probably just Edge, yeah. And then you would get, in metro area, you get the 3G performance,
I noticed just looking at the spec sheets, there's tiny little differences, like a few differences in a few grams of weight and the different processor numbers. Are they the same under the bonnet?
Yeah, basically they are the same board, just a slight little tweak in the performance of the processor.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously with a slight tweak in the processor, there's a slight difference in the weight.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've heard, listeners would know, Dr. Ron's got a HTC Dream and he's not always happy with the battery life. What advice would you have for him?
So Dr. Ron, what you need to do is download one of the applications from the marketplace, the Android market. There's battery monitor. There's probably about 10 different applications I've seen there, and it allows you to monitor what the applications or functions such as the compass or the GPS that are using the battery, and you can turn some of those functions off, and that will help you monitor the battery and get better improvement. The second thing which is going to improve the performance is that when the 1.5 version is available for Dream, which we expect to be in the next couple of months or even in a shorter period of time, that will also improve your battery performance as well.
So you said that the battery life is generally a bit better on the Magic. That's mostly due to the fact that it's running 1.5?
Yeah, due to 1.5, slightly a bit bigger battery. Mainly due to 1.5. I've been using my phone. I'm a heavy voice user, and voice is actually one of the heavy uses of it. And I've got my push mail running on it as well, and I'm getting a full day out of it.
And Google Latitude comes pre-installed on this?
Yeah, that's correct. With the Google Maps, you've got the Latitude functionality in there. And for people who don't know what Latitude is, it's a permission-based, I need to make that clear, so you can control, but it's a permission-based ability for you to see where your friends are.
Yeah, and for them to see where you are.
Correct,
if you want them. So the permissions are only one-on-one. You can't create a group of, we'll say, 10 people and say, right, I want everyone in this group to be able to see me.
That's correct. Yeah. At the moment, it's just on a one-to-one basis. Yeah. And I think that's quite good because then you, as an individual user, have that power of whether you want that to do. And that is really what we all want and need.
So you said that if you want someone else to be able to see you, they need a Google account as well, a Gmail account.
Correct.
Will it work with Google Apps? Like if they've got Google Apps for Business or something, so it's not a Gmail account, but it's a Google-powered email address.
Yeah.
Well, do you know if Latitude works with that?
Not sure, actually. Yeah. I think that's probably one thing we would probably check with Google App for you.
I get my review in, I'll check that out.
Yeah.
One of the things I notice is it still doesn't have the pinch-to-zoom functionality on the browser, and I know that's an ongoing thing with Apple. Is that something we're likely to ever see added?
The zoom, how we do the zoom is literally you touch the screen and you can zoom in and out and pan around. I personally don't know if that's something that's locked down to Apple or not, but that's the way we're addressing and how we provide the zoom functionality.
And so what else should we expect from HTC later this year?
Some very exciting products, Adam. an expansion of our Windows mobile platforms, okay? And some of the products have already been announced. We'll see some of those products coming available in Australia, mm-hmm. And an expansion of our Android platforms as well.
So we should expect to see more Android phones
definitely
this year.
You'll definitely see some more Android handsets from HTC this year.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for your time.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Now, Dr. Ron, moving on here, you and I were having a chat during the course of the week about registering.com.au names. Now, did
the
you
pain,
have
the horror.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, no, it wasn't that bad.
But did you try and do it through Telstra or something?
No, I didn't. No, I used my registrar of choice, but they're very...
What happened?
Well, I registered okay. I was registering it on behalf of a customer, and because my business name had nothing whatsoever to do with the domain name .com.au that I was trying to register, I got the 20 questions.
What really?
Do you want to register this? Yeah. Who are you registering it on behalf of? What's the contact at the company you're registering it on behalf of? What's their contact telephone number?
Yep.
And they wanted to know a lot of business details, which they wouldn't normally be asking for if you wanted to register a .net.au or a .org.au domain name. So I was able to answer all the questions. That wasn't a problem. But yeah, it's good in a way when you think about it, because they're probably going out of their way to make sure that people aren't cyber squatting, which means they're not deliberately, intentionally registering names to which they have no association at all, so they can just sit there and try and on-sell it for more money. So it's probably a good thing.
Cyber squatting is the practice of buying domain names, especially the cheaper they get. People do this. Well, when I say people make a business out of this. They actually buy up domain names. They put a web page up there which has got advertising on it, where they get paid per impression, paid per click type advertising. So when you mistype someone's address, or you go to a .net or a different sort of domain suffix, you end up seeing their goddamn page, which is a holding page with full of ads.
If you type microsoft.com by mistake or something, because you've made a typo on the keyboard, yeah, it'll go to their site.
Yeah.
And say, hey, were you looking for microsoft.com? But in the meantime, look at all this advertising we're going to throw at you.
Yeah, and that's how they make their money. They get these, a couple of cents per page, but at the end of the day,
you get hundreds of thousands of hits a day from people just making typos.
Absolutely. If you've got, even you could run a server in the office, really, just plug in another domain name, plug and put it all to the run one sort of web server, and just get impression after impression after impression, and make a fortune.
So in this country, they're trying to stamp that out. They're trying to prevent it by making the registration process for the .com.au's quite, well, not difficult, but
anyway, we've had 5,000 days of web, and I've been a lot of domain name registrations in that time. I'm tipping. .com and .net have been probably the two biggest of everything, and yes. Where to from here? Joining us in the studio this evening is George Pongas. He's the COO, which is the Chief Operating Officer of Domain Central. Hello, George. Thanks for coming in and having a chat with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the show.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you do for Domain Central? What is Domain Central?
Well, we're a domain registrar and hosting provider. So we register domain names for people, and we enable them to get onto the internet and use their website, email, managed services, managed exchange, a whole lot of related services that they can use with or without their domain name.
Okay, a managed exchange, that's a mail client, I think. Yes. That's all the businessy side of stuff. But so in essence, you're a provider of domain names and a provider of hosting facilities for people that want to get online.
Exactly right.
What do you do for them? What's an operating officer do? You put out fires?
I'm not exactly sure, but I pretty much answer all the questions that get thrown at me by staff and various other people. And I look after more the registrar side of the business.
Okay.
So I keep up with policy, find out what's going on in the wider world, if you like, the community as such.
I guess you're never sitting there twiddling your thumbs, George. There's always something to do.
Well, there's always time to twiddle the thumbs. but yeah, no, definitely there's always something to do too.
It's that sort of industry, isn't it? Do you reckon I'm on the money there? Well, I get 20 questions now if I want to register a .com.au domain, just trying to keep the namespace legitimate, I guess, for want of a better word.
Sure. Well, I mean, .au has been a protected space, and it's been deregulated over time. So once upon a time, you could not register a domain name unless it was very closely associated to your business, had to be a direct match or a variation of your business or service. Now they've introduced a new policy called close and substantial connection. So that pretty much means anything. And as of last year, they now allow you to monetize domain names. So what you're talking about earlier, which is putting up ads on a domain name, is acceptable now according to AU policy. So we've seen over a period of time deregulation of the .au space, although there is still requirements such as having an ABN or an ACN to get a .com.au. And as a result, it's a very trusted space. So the consumers out there know when they go to a .com.au domain name, that, you know, there's a real business behind it. Well, there is a paper trail, if you like, to find out who's got the domain.
It used to be that you couldn't sell .au domain names from one user to another.
Correct.
You had to wait for them to expire and then pick them up. Is that still the case?
Well, it used to be you could sell them only if you sold the business or the business asset along with the domain name. So
okay.
If you had a business and you sold your company,
But the domain name would still belong to the same business, so you'd have to sell the business rather than the domain name.
Exactly right. But as of last year, they had a panel. I was on that panel, actually, and we discussed whether or not the average person understood that they can't sell the domain name, and after research into the subject matter, most owners of a domain name or registrants assumed that they could sell the domain name, and it was something that they owned. So they've recently changed that policy, and you can now sell your domain name, providing that you wait 6 months from the time of registration, and also that you didn't originally register the domain for the pure purpose of reselling the domain.
And so presumably the person you're selling to would also have to qualify to own the domain under the closest
exactly right.
One of the other rules, yeah.
Yep.
So that eliminates a bit of the cyber squatting potential that goes on in the .com and .net namespace, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
by
comparison, does. If you're wanting to register a .com, it's extremely easy. Very, very cheap.
Yeah. $6 or something you can pick them up for, yeah.
You don't need to qualify who or why, what you tend to do with the domain name, or there's no one checking to see that you meet eligibility. But there are some policy requirements. You do need to have an address associated with the domain name, etc. But it's a 7-year-old with a credit card can get online and register a .com. But you need to have an ABN or an ACN to register a .com.au or a .net.au.
What are your thoughts, George, on the relevance of, I guess, geospatial reference, .com.au being an Australian corporation or company in an Australian namespace, as opposed to .com?
Well, I mean, every country's got its own CCLD, so country
what?
code level domain. So .au,
Graham. Yeah.
So .au is a country code of Australia, .uk, United Kingdom, etc. In Australia, we don't allow anyone to register at the top level, so you can't register your company name .au. They only allow you to register.
We can't have techtalkradio.au.
No, you can have .com.au, but not. So that's a second level.
Right.
So you can register at the second level, but not at the top level. I think it's a great whether you allow people to register at the top level or not. I think what's happened with .au is it's a very strong brand. It's been marketed very well in Australia, and there's that level of trust where you do trust anyone selling online with a .com.au.
And some other countries do allow that, though, don't they? I think Canada do, and several European countries
do. Well, I think Japan allow, if you're a Japanese company or corporation, you can register co.jp, but if you're an international company wanting to register a Japanese domain name, you can register your company name .jp at the top level.
I registered .co.uk the other day, which was, I just thought, well, I've got something that I need to register over there, and it didn't throw anything up to say that, hey, who are you? Are you really a bona fide type sort of applicant for that domain space? And so I registered it. So that was pretty simple and straightforward.
One of our chat room people, George, says Australians should know about .id.au. What's that namespace used for?
That's for individuals. So, if you're a private individual wanting to have the domain name like george.id.au, because of the restrictions with ComAU needing to have an ABN, they introduced .id.au to allow individuals to have their own domain name. And that's where that. And so you can basically register that without having to have an ABN, ACN, or anything else. It just needs to be a name that relates to your own personal name or nickname that you're referred to by.
Okay, so not too many checks and balances.
Well, if we see as a domain registrar someone putting through Microsoft.id.au, we probably get that, we knock it back. Yeah, we get it all the time. We get it all the time.
So. Now, with those ID.au, that sounds like a great idea. Can you use that for email? And can you use that for putting a web page up? Can you put your blog on it?
Anything,
all that sort of stuff?
Anything you like.
Anything you like.
It's a domain name. It's a domain name in function, and no different to a .com or a .com.au. It's just that people aren't aware of it. So if you're to tell somebody verbally your domain name,
they wouldn't believe you.
Well, they'll probably go back and forget what it is, or by mistake put .com.au because we're kind of conditioned to automatically type in .com.au.
Yeah. Yep. So, but you can use email, and what you'd need to get someone to host that for you, unless you've got your own server at home or something like that. Yeah.
A lot of people actually redirect it to their MySpace page, for instance, or Facebook page.
Oh yeah.
Or an email forwarding or web forwarding service.
That's still a kind of hosting, though, isn't it? You still need to have. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
So AUDA is the Australian Domain Namespace Register. They're in Melbourne, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Yeah. One of the questions that I have, and if you're working closely with them, what determines the price of a domain name? Like, in theory, to me, it's just a database entry in a database somewhere which says, oh, this was registered to these people. How come some are cheaper? Why does the price vary?
Well, AUDA basically are a body that are appointed to look after the integrity of the .au space. So they are basically... look after policy, introduce policy, make sure that nothing untowards is happening in the .au space, and the integrity is kept in the space. The registry is Oz Registry. They actually maintain the database, as you said.
Are they a separate company?
Well, AUDA is a non-profit organisation. Oz Registry is a company. It's a private company, and they won a tender to look after the registry. Internationally is VeriSign.com and .net, or look after the registry there. Nominate are the .co.uk registry, and they're the regulator as well.
Just to get this clear, AUDA set the rules.
They're the
and
regulator.
Oz Registry carry it out.
Oz Registry look after the infrastructure that makes it all work.
Yeah, so they own the nuts and bolts. They make the computers keep working and all that sort of stuff.
Exactly.
But AUDA set the rules and regulations.
Exactly right.
Do you know much about AUDA? How many on the board and how does it function?
I can't remember the specifics of the board. AUDA.org.au is their website.
Yeah.
They function. There is a board as such.
Are they interested parties, like a Telstra involved in it, or is it more so individuals that are involved in the decision making?
There are industry participants on the board,
mm-hmm.
and that may be from the supply class, such as registrars,
mm-hmm.
or the demand class as well. In fact, I think they're just going to elect some new board members now. So it's a
democratic process about how the namespace evolves and works.
Exactly right.
So what's the process in a new namespace? We see .com.au's, .net.au's, and we're all familiar with those. What about new namespaces that come along? I'm sure that's going to happen because the revolution rolls on.
Yeah. Well, ICANN have announced recently that they are going to introduce they're opening it up, and they're saying, let's get some more top-level domains. Next year, it's hard to tell because it's an ongoing process and they're feeling their way through it, but they are going to tender and release a whole new swag of top-level domain names, which will be very interesting, and it will change the whole landscape of how the internet is used on different levels.
We've sort of speaking a little bit earlier before we came on air about geospatial referencing. Now, Google's always been... And I won't speak specifically about Google, but as a user going to a search engine and typing in a series of keywords looking for a particular service or product in your location, how important, I guess, is the domain name when it comes to a geospatial reference? Is that of relevance, I guess, in the big picture? Like, are we going to start seeing even more defined? Like, we talk about .com.au being Australia. What are the chances of seeing
.com.vic for Victoria, .com.queensland or something like that. Is that a possibility?
Oh, definitely so. Definitely so. And at the top-level domains like .paris, .melbourne, .sydney, even more specific to that area. If Melbourne were to apply the tender to get their own top-level domain, then you would imagine that if you were a user of the internet in the Melbourne area and you're searching for something, that .melbourne as a domain extension would be served to you very high up in the organic results of Google or Yahoo or whoever.
So as an example, George, the tourism people might register the name tourism.melbourne, and that would be it. That would just be their domain name. There would be no .au on the end or no .com.au or anything.
Exactly right. That would be the top level.
That will really change the way we see domain names, won't it? Well, the way we think about things?
Absolutely.
The top-level domain in your example would be the .melbourne.
Exactly.
So the tourism.melbourne would be something that whoever owns .melbourne would be able to then allocate, that you could have someone, you know, let's say the city of Melbourne bought .melbourne, then they'd be able to say, all right, who wants to be the tourism provider? And I'll give you .tourism.melbourne. And who wants to be the transport, you know, provider? And I'll give you .transport.melbourne. And, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Precisely right.
This exactly. is going to open up a wealth of, I guess, new ideas and new business opportunities.
New business models, for sure.
A lot of organisations based on, you know, .Broken Hill, .Cairns.
Exactly.
You know, you can come along and find out more about a specific town. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron and Graham in this evening. Our guest this evening is George Pongus. He's the COO of Domain Central, and we're talking all about things called top-level domains and domain names for the internet, which is pretty important for, I'd say, nearly anybody who's wants to get online as a business or even as an individual. Now, George, the top-level domains which we're starting to talk about now, like .melbourne, .paris, .whatever you want, they've got to be pricey, I would imagine, because they're truly global in a lot of respects. There's not a designator about what type of entity it is. It's just a name, isn't it?
What if there's a .melbourne in the United States? If there's a Melbourne, there's a city in the United States, and they say, no,
we're in Florida.
In Florida, we want .melbourne.
Okay,
we're going to have a bidding war between Florida and Victoria.
I know, put it up on eBay. That'll fix it.
Pretty much. Well, they're going to, it goes to tender. You need to present your business case to ICANN. They'll look at all this and see whether or not you can run your own space. If there is more than one, it's basically the best person wins out. If one of those people that are tendering for the space decides to go to auction, then it's a person with the deepest pockets wins.
So don't you like the free world society of capitalism, isn't it?
And where does the money go? Just to ask a naive question.
Actually, I'm not exactly sure, but I'm sure it goes to ICANN.
Not to a charity, I can tell you.
It would go to ICANN, and it would go towards the running of the maintaining of all the plan and the planning of the system.
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
The domain name system.
I haven't thought of that, but surely someone's going to benefit.
It won't be you and me either, just quietly. Not unless we put our thinking caps on fast.
So this is really going to open up a lot of potential. When do we see these new domains become available? And seriously, what's the starting price? Like, we look at a .com we mentioned earlier, you know, you're $6, we'll get you one
bucks,
of those.
Yeah.
You look at .com.au, maybe anywhere from $30 to $100, depending on whichever registrar you go with. Where do you go to get these guys, and what are we looking at?
Well, I mean, I'd say that it would be anywhere between $250,000 to $500,000 to go through the process of tendering. And then just the infrastructure alone would be more having the servers and the equipment to maintain your own space. But you're not looking at it. It's not a domain name that you're registering. You're owning that top-level domain that you own, the .com, for argument's sake. So
yeah, it'd be like if you said, I want to own .com. Everything .com now belongs to me.
Exactly right.
Yeah, it's a massive commitment,
and
isn't it?
A good example is a BMW. So BMW have BMW.com, and every time they have a new car release, they 320i.bmw.com. They can go and get their own extension, .bmw, and every time they have a new car release or any product release, they just put the 320i.bmw.
But they can also do things like sell subdomains to their dealers.
Exactly right.
So you could have .vic.bmw and then put all the dealers within Victoria as, you know,
exactly right.
Whatever location.
Isn't that what the government does now? As in .gov.au, you go to .vic.gov, .nsw.gov.
Yeah, that's
same principles apply, really, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yep. Only under this new system, someone could, you know, it's in private hands. So you just buy the top-level domain that you want.
Exactly right. And they own that space. So, for instance, someone might go in and cyber squat their name in .com because they got in there before BMW did. Or there's a new product that BMW haven't even thought of releasing right now, which is 45392.bmw.
Yep.
Someone may have just taken a punt and registered that .com. They can't get that off that person, or they've got to go through intellectual property arbitration and take it to WIPO, which is sort of where you go and fight out intellectual property disputes.
You have deep pockets for that too, I would imagine.
If you own .bmw because you are BMW, then you don't need to fight anybody. You control registry
everything that goes
operator.
On that, yeah. Exactly. Now, one last question. Is there any reason, you say you own a namespace, and therefore what you do is set up subdomains under that. Mm-hmm. Is there any reason why you couldn't use it raw, as it were? You just type BMW into a web browser and you get the BMW homepage?
Well, I think it pretty much already works that way anyway. It defaults, most browsers default to the .com. Maybe if you typed in .bmw. It would work. That comes down to how the browser vendors make their software work.
Well, the browsers will have to take into account now that they can't predict that something without anything on it like that might need something added to it.
It's going to change the way browsers work, and it's going to change the way search works as well.
It's going to have massive implications on search, I would imagine. Anyway, we'll wait and see what happens there. Ashkan on our chat has asked a question. So if I have an ABN and my business name is, say, Sun Industries, and I want to register Moon Fun, is that okay?
Yes, it is.
There you go. You just need to have something which I guess is similar or part of a project that you're doing? Or
We don't check or vet what you're going to do with a domain name. You warrant to us that it's a close to substantial connection. The space, the .au space, is a complaints-driven space. So if someone goes out and complains about what you're doing or that you don't meet eligibility, typically we check to make sure that that's okay, that you do meet policy, or it goes to AUDA and they ask a few questions based on the response. They determine whether you can continue to keep that domain name or not.
Okay, so there is an appeals process if someone wants to challenge it. All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. We're talking to George Pontus this evening, the COO of Domain Central. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back very shortly. If you've got any questions, come and visit us on chat.techtalkradio.com.au.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
The 43-year-old claims he was looking for evidence of UFOs and aliens.
Well, did NASA get hacked as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
No, really?
If you need high speed and high quality at the same time, you need a much more powerful transmitter.
It automatically offered me the latest Optus configuration file.
How long did they take to get back to you? And how did they get back to you?
By the time you finished your cheeseburger, it was full too hard and you drove away.
That's right.
Somebody else in the world will have had the same problem.
Latitude's everything to me. I like knowing where Dr. Ron is at any particular hour of the day. Or my wife, for that matter.
But they're both of them together.
Hang on a minute. What does that mean?
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan. He's caught him short. He's gone out for a drink.
You need to lengthen that stinger because it creeps up on us every time.
We're all sitting here. Hang on a minute.
Are we on?
Absolutely.
Uh-oh.
Anyway. And joining us this evening is our guest, George, from I lost my notes.
Domain Central.
Domain Central, that's right. During the break, we've had a few interesting questions pop up on the chat at the moment, but AUDA, the domain registrar, we've covered a bit about them and what their role is, but a good question during the break was this .au.com, which seems to be floating around a little bit. What's the deal with that one, George?
Well, that's just a .com domain name that was registered a while back, back in the
someone who had the foresight into looking.
Exactly right. And they sell domain names at the, what's that, the first, the third level on that space. So they own the au.com and they sell subdomains, if you like.
That's a good get, really, isn't it?
It's actually a really good space to... I wouldn't mind owning that
one. I know. You'd do well, wouldn't you? Yes. A-U-D-A. Anyway, it's one they probably picked up for $6 as opposed to many hundreds of thousands.
Well, the interesting thing with no matter how expensive a .com is, it could be a $10 million domain name, the renewal price is always the same. It's only $7
a year. Yeah. So where are we going to go? What's going to happen? We're going to see all sorts of domain names come onto the market. Obviously, geospatial is one aspect of domain names. What about descriptions? Obviously, you can do anything. Are they going to have any rules? Because there was always that. I remember, was it 12 months ago? There was the brouhaha about the .xxx domain names and stuff like that. Are there going to be things that we can do and can't do?
Sure, and that's what the whole ICANN process is about. They're going to be so if you want to have your own top level domain, you're going to need to present a tender and prove to ICANN that you can manage effectively the space, both from a technology perspective and from also a do not cause harm to others on the internet perspective as well. You know, they won't allow you to register a misspelling of .com, for instance. You know, Cameroon is an interesting one. Cameroon has the top level .cm. So that space or that country is one big misspelling. So google.cm.
People haven't hit the O in the com and they go to exactly a Cameroon
right.
address.
And they were monetizing, which is the practice of deriving money from ad revenue on those park pages that you see. They monetized the entire and wildcarded the entire space. And then they got called up for it and I think they're releasing it relatively soon.
I think
I've
read something about that. Yeah. That's very funny, actually, isn't it? Well, I mean, nothing like a good idea at the time, really, is it?
Well, yeah. That's what the internet's about, I suppose.
Absolutely. How are we going in respect to Australian registrations? Are we a fairly a country which likes to register a lot of domain names or compared to other countries? Or?
Well, there are just over a million AU domain names. I think we're rapidly approaching the millionth com.au domain name. So I think we've got about 900 and some small change in com AUs and 150 or so net AUs and then the rest. Compared to .com, I think there are 70 million.
Ooh.
Who manages the .com space?
VeriSign do.
VeriSign, that's yes. Right. I mentioned that earlier. We know the name VeriSign from security certificates. Yes. Same mob, is it?
Same mob.
Hmm. Now, what about... Just because we're in the wonderful world of mobile devices these days. .mobi.
Mm-hmm. We've got a techtalkradio.mobi and a ttr.mobi for our program.
Good idea at the time. Are they working, do you reckon?
They are. They're, I think it's a space that's embraced by all the mobile phone carriers as well. So Motorola and Ericsson and the like supported that space or that top level when it was released. The success of a top-level domain is based upon how well it's marketed at the end of the day.
Yeah,
like
it's all about
else.
User recognition, whether exactly a user right. trusts it and recognises it, yeah.
And the good thing about .mobi is that I think if you register a .mobi, they give you free apps to mobile phone-ify, if you like, your website and to make it friendly to WAP services or the like. So I think that's got some traction.
It's quite a challenge building websites these days because you just, like, you have the round table. What size do you want your website? And everyone sort of picks a random number and you go, well, why do you want that? And you go, well, who else is using what? And anyway, at the moment, I don't know what the current going sort of, because everyone's got widescreen laptops and not quite so deep and things like that. But the Mobi device was allegedly brought in so that you would be building applications that would fit, 320 by 100 and whatever pixels. But a lot of the new mobile devices are actually pretty smart. They can actually... Well, look at iPhones, for example, but even some of the earlier Sony Ericssons and Nokias and things like that can do the crunching for you and get it sort of somewhat readable. Wasn't that a condition of Mobi to actually sort of say, well, it's got to be readable for a small device?
Well, exactly. And I think their aim is that, you can't almost get it right when it's a .mobi. You have to absolutely get it right so that as a user, it's all about end-user experience. And as a user, I've got a mobile device. I, after a period of time, will automatically type in domain name .mobi because I know that the actual interface or the user interface on my screen will work as it's intended and not be a rendering close to what it's intended to be.
We've tried to use the KISS principle on the TTR.mobi site, so just try to keep it very simple. There's no
for those bandwidth impaired people, or
well,
people
that's the whole point. It's for people who don't have a great deal of bandwidth, or if they do have bandwidth, it's maybe expensive.
Well, they're not on a data plan. And
they're not on a massive data plan.
For...
That's right. They're not going to have fancy flash software and things that you'd normally expect people to have on web browsers. So just simple, lots of simple text and. And try and make the links easy to navigate, because people aren't using a mouse either when they're navigating .mobi sites.
Warlock was saying .mobi is great for internet banking. Makes sense, really, doesn't it?
There you go.
If you want to go to combank.mobi or whoever the big bankers are and all that sort of stuff, do your internet banking. There's a list for a question from Wazza. Is there a list of .mobi websites anywhere? I think there is.
We've got a very, very brief one on our site.
Have we?
Yeah, we do, but...
Should read it.
It's got our site on it.
It does.
No, it doesn't have our site on it. No, it has got others, but there are directories around where people are slowly adding the .mobi sites as they become mainstream.
Don't the .mobi people run their own directory of some kind?
Or? Oh, maybe they do, Graham. We'll have to have a look.
I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe just jump on Google. Ask the gods. They know all these sort of things, don't they? .mobi listings and things
like that. .mobi directory or something.
Yeah, all right. George, thank you very much for coming in and visiting us and spending an hour with us this evening. It's been most informative about top-level domains. I think we've got all sorts of information out of it, especially, exciting times ahead. I don't know whether I can't remember whether I asked you this question. When are we going to start seeing these little guys, the big ones, come onto the web browser?
I think mid-2009 is when they're going to have ended the or started the actual tender process. So probably won't be until 2010 and when they're starting to be released, imagine. Or second half of 2009 at the earliest.
Hopefully we'll have a global economy that can support the prices that looks like it's going to be up for auction. The biggest person can buy it. But all right. Well, we look forward to the changing landscape around 2009, 2010 maybe. After the auctions take place, and we'll take it from there. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. And if you want to register a domain name, check out these guys. It's probably a good domaincentral.com.au.
That's it.
Thank you very much. See, that's the way it works, isn't it? We all know. What do you reckon, Dr. Ron?
I'm going to register Dr. Ron as a top level domain. What do you think about that?
Dr. Ron is a top
hard disk collection. Dr. Ron.
Oh, don't start that. You'll get them all. You'll get them all chatting and doing all sorts of things again.
We hope you've enjoyed this instalment of the Tech Talk Radio Summer Series. We'll be airing these best of compilations over the Christmas and New Year break while the panellists are off merrymaking and doing whatever it is that Tech Talk panellists do on a Monday night when they're not up here at the radio station. This time last week, we were winding up the very first ever Tech Talk Radio Outside broadcast, which was run live from the Sophia Family Restaurant in Burwood East. This was a terrific night, and all of the panellists would like to thank everyone for their attendance and support. It was great to be able to put names to faces at long last, and to give away some great door prizes as well. Don't forget you can keep in touch with us via the forum. Simply go to forum.techtalkradio.com.au for show notes of each and every episode, discussion of current topics, links to websites mentioned during each program, and everything else you could possibly need. You can follow each of the presenters on Twitter as well. For a list of all our Twitter accounts, simply hit our homepage, which is at techtalkradio.com.au. And on the right-hand side, there's a link that says, check out the team Twitter page. I suggest you do so. Of course, you can download each and every episode. You can watch many of our shows on Ustream, thanks to the fabulous webcam technology that JD connects up most weeks. And if there's anything you're unsure of, the Tech Talk website is the best place to start. Now, if you've had a bad technology experience and you need to get something off your chest, and you just can't wait till we return next year, then you probably should visit our sister site. /Rant gives you the opportunity to get it off your chest. It's a place where anyone can air their technology grievances about poor or shoddy products or services. Simply go to the Tech Talk website, click on our sites, /rant, and have a rant. I think you'll find it's very therapeutic. All right then, next week we'll have another entertaining summer series highlights package ready and waiting to go, and we'll be returning live to the studio on the 14th of February next year. So from me, Dr. Ron, enjoy the Christmas break, and I'm looking forward to your company again next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Justin Dunlop, Graham Callaghan and Lena van der Venter. Expert opinion is provided by Adam Turner, and our US correspondents are Lydia Davis and Mark Diggins. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. The show is broadcast, recorded and streamed live each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC in Melbourne. The crew wishes to thank all the stations around Australia that rebroadcast Tech Talk Radio each week. Tech Talk Radio is also available for syndication on your local station. For sponsorship and advertising inquiries, call 03-8682-9099 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval. We'll